Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and WETS HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Now, if you're a longtime listener to this show, you will perhaps remember that we have done a couple of episodes in the past on the Japanese internments, or more properly, the Japanese incarcerations of World War II. We did two episodes called Fred Korematsu, All-American, where we profiled perhaps the most prominent resistor of the Japanese-American incarcerations, Fred Korematsu, by interviewing his daughter, who did an absolutely marvelous job. Her name is Karen Korematsu, of telling us all about Fred and all about his journey. And it was a very sad tale, a very disturbing tale, but a very uplifting tale, because if you recall correctly, at the end of all of this, after decades of struggle, Fred was not only vindicated, he was not only compensated in some small measure, but he was actually given the Presidential Award of Freedom by President Bill Clinton back in 1998. Now, while I was doing my research for that episode, or for those episodes, I came across another little-known aspect of this entire incarceration of the Japanese Americans in World War II. It had to do with those Japanese Americans who didn't fit the standard narrative. And by that I mean that the standard narrative is that the Japanese Americans were cooperative, that nobody resisted, that they quietly gathered up their suitcases and marched off to the camps and quietly left the camps as the war wound down and never complained about it. That, in fact, even some of them volunteered for the military and served with distinction in the army and the other forces. I mean, that's all true, but it is often characterized as being the only truth. And there's another truth about this period in our history, and that is that some of the Japanese Americans resisted. They resisted legally. They objected to what was happening to them. And these people, of course, were considered troublemakers, not only by the U.S. government, but by some of their fellow prisoners. And they were all concentrated in a place called Tule Lake in California. I have a really interesting interview today with a woman named Barbara Decay, one of whose parents was at Tule Lake and who has done a great deal of research on the subject.
My name is Barbara Decay. I am a member of the Tule Lake Committee, and the Tule Lake Committee is involved with organizing pilgrimages to the Tule Lake site.
Well, please tell us what the Tule Lake site is.
The Tule Lake site is one of the 10 World War II concentration camp sites that the government created to imprison people of Japanese ancestry. In other words, anybody who had a Japanese face who lived on the West Coast was subject to a forced removal from their communities and their homes and sent to concentration camps out in the middle of nowhere.
Right here in the United States.
Right.
Two
of them were in California.
Mm-hmm.
One in Southern California called Manzanar, and the second was in Northern California on the California-Oregon border, and that was known as Tule Lake.
All right. Now, before we get specifically to Tule Lake, this is a tale that sadly, many Americans are not that familiar with, so could you back up to the beginning and tell us about this whole issue of Japanese internment, Japanese-American internment in the United States during World War II? How did this come about?
Well, first of all, I would like to clarify that the term internment only applies to people who were not U.S. citizens.
Okay.
So the government, when Pearl Harbor happened, the government had been surveillance going on of the Japanese American community, and that surveillance it was looking at people who were leaders within the Japanese American community. So these were the ministers, they were the language teachers, they were people who were somewhat prominent within the community. And most of these were issei, that is, they were people who were immigrants from Japan. And there were laws that prohibited these immigrants from becoming U.S. citizens. It was a racist, discriminatory immigration policy. So the immigration policy meant that all of these Japanese immigrants could not become citizens. So they were known as, or the leaders were known as enemy aliens. And many of them, thousands of them, were picked up after Pearl Harbor. Picked up and interned in Department of Justice internment camps. So when we talk about internment, we're trying to differentiate the universe a little better.
Right.
So it's clearer not only to our people within our community, but people outside of the community who are concerned about immigration policy issues. That, you know, there was this separate treatment and very racist and discriminatory treatment of people of color who were immigrants to the U.S.
Right. And you mentioned the term internment. It, more generally, I've seen it used exactly as you say, when war breaks out between two nations and each of those nations has what are now enemy aliens within its borders, they will intern those people, and typically they exchange them at some point. Or at least historically that's happened. And so there were these people who were not allowed to become American citizens, I heard you say, right?
Right, right.
And so they, internment is the proper terminology for that group, but I'm guessing that's a relatively small percentage of the people of Japanese ancestry who ultimately were imprisoned.
Well, two-thirds of the people who were imprisoned were American citizens, and then, of course, the one-third were the immigrants who could not become citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a forced removal of all of the Japanese communities on the West Coast. People were, in certain places, people were given only 2 days to get rid of everything they owned and figure out what they were going to do.
Okay, now on the one hand, one can understand that enemy aliens, it might be appropriate to segregate them and exchange them, as we just described, but two-thirds of the people we're talking about are American citizens. They just happen to be of Japanese descent. Let's be clear on that, right?
Right.
And that's extraordinary. So American citizens are getting 2 days' notice and being told to do what?
Well, they're being told to leave their homes and their communities. And the government created these concentration camps to house them. The terminology, the government created all of this euphemistic terminology.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to kind of calling Japanese American, well, treating anybody with a Japanese face as somebody who is loyal to Japan rather than loyal to the country that they have chosen to live their lives and raise their families in, they're treated as untrustworthy because of their faces. So there was just an indiscriminate roundup and creation of these prisons that had barbed wire and guard towers, and they existed for 4 to 5 years to imprison people.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were 110,000 people of Japanese ancestry who were removed and placed in these camps. And they were scattered in states, Utah, there were, you know, in California there were two, in Idaho, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, two were in Arkansas, there were two in Arizona.
Are any of these camps preserved?
Yeah, there's a preservation effort going on at most of these camps. And Tule Lake is now part of the National Park Service. So the Park Service is going to be preserving Tule Lake. Manzanar is already a Park Service site, and there is a beautiful and really wonderfully done visitor center that's in Southern California, And also the Park Service is working on preserving the site in Minidoka, or the Minidoka site, which is in Idaho.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned Tule Lake several times. Why in particular are you interested in Tule Lake, and what is Tule Lake? What makes it special?
Well, I got involved in Tule Lake because it is it became a segregation center for all of the people who protested. Now, and the reason why this was so interesting to me is, you know, I grew up during the Civil Rights Movement in Michigan. And, you know, there was a Japanese-American diaspora that was created after World War II, in which the government basically tried to destroy the Japanese-American communities and scatter people all over the country, and encourage people to settle in areas where there were no other Japanese-Americans. So my family ended up in Michigan, where growing up during the Civil Rights Movement, during all of the protest over social justice issues, I always wondered why, you know, I had never heard any of the stories about Japanese Americans protesting this really horrific removal program. It made no sense to me. Why didn't Japanese Americans protest? Why wasn't there, you know, grassroots dissent all over the place?
Yeah, that's the image one gets of it if one knows anything about it at all. Certainly the popular conception is that there was no protest at all. There was not a single voice raised.
Right. The image is that Japanese Americans were cooperative, you know, almost passive and sheep-like in following the government's orders, and that they went to these camps and they had a wonderful time because the government took care of them and they were all happy. So that was the image that I grew up with, which, again, it's so dissonant to what I knew with other civil rights and social justice issues, that when you treat people like that, typically you can expect that they will be angry or they will be outraged, and that you will have stories of resistance. So it wasn't until I started doing research on Tule Lake, which was about 10, 15 years ago, that I realized that Tule Lake was the camp that told the stories of all of those people who resisted. But because of the government propaganda program, which many Japanese Americans went along with, the image that the government sought to promote was that those people who protested were disloyal.
Hmm.
Any form of dissent or protest was treated as disloyalty, and those people were sent to Tule Lake. And because of this internalized racism, or it's like the Stockholm syndrome, in which the prisoner kind of takes on the values of the person that is imprisoning them.
Mm-hmm.
That was the phenomena that was happening with Japanese Americans. That, you know, people were so traumatized by this mass incarceration program that they learned that the government, while it was a pretty brutal removal program and incarceration program. And then those people who the government administered while everybody's in prison for with no due process, the government administers a loyalty questionnaire. So here you've got people who are unjustly removed, put in these concentration camps, and then the government asks them to answer a loyalty questionnaire.
Oh, wow.
And the loyalty questionnaire covered two issues. One was if people were willing to serve in the military. And the second question was if they were willing to disavow their loyalty to the emperor of Japan, which, of course, assumed that they were loyal to Japan.
Right.
So a lot of people would just refuse to answer the questionnaire. And there were other people who answered. They gave the proper, the desired yes answers. I will serve and I will disavow my loyalty. But they qualified their answers, saying, you know, yes, if you free my family, or yes, if, you know, you release my, release us from prison. Those kinds of answers were defined as disloyalty.
Hmm.
It's pretty shocking, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, this is, I think, again, a detail that even people who have heard of this this thing in a macro sense have not really known about. So
right.
The whole loyalty oath thing.
So 10% of the population refused to give the unqualified yes answers that mm-hmm. the government wanted. And that 10%, which was over 12,000 people, ended up segregated in Tule Lake and defined as people who were disloyal. I mean, again, this is, it's really shocking, the lack of due process, the lack of representation. People really didn't understand or know what the consequences of their answers would be.
Now, was Tule Lake different in terms of its physical environs, or the level of security, or the level of privation that its inmates endured?
Yeah, Tule Lake was a maximum security concentration camp after segregation. They added there were 28 guard towers, and these were armed soldiers. A battalion of soldiers were then assigned, so there were 1,000 soldiers guarding the prisoners at Tule Lake, because the image or the thinking was that the government was going to cull all the disloyal people in one site, so they could begin releasing people from the other camps,
mm-hmm.
because they again realized that this was probably an overreaction that had very questionable legal and illegal consequences. It was a violation. People in government realized this was a violation.
Did they actually follow through on that? I mean, did they actually start releasing people from the other camps?
People in the other camps, if they were cleared as loyal, they could go to other parts of the country if they had a job. Or younger people, you know, who are college age, could go to apply to college if they could find a way to, you know, pay for the tuition and make those sort of arrangements. So the government was trying. Within a few months, they started trying to empty out the camps.
Mm-hmm.
But then,
I heard you say to other parts, so they still couldn't go out into, I think it was called the military exclusion zone,
right,
on the West Coast.
On the West Coast.
So they couldn't go back to their own homes,
right,
on the coast, but they could go elsewhere in the country.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Now, I mean, the whole justification was given for this is that the government was worried about sabotage, or it was worried about espionage. I wonder how that rationale played out. I mean, you could still commit, if you wanted to, a person could still commit espionage or sabotage in Chicago or Miami as easily as they could have done in San Francisco, right? So was there any logic to that at all, this diaspora that you describe?
Well, General DeWitt, who was in charge of the four, he was the Army Lieutenant General who was in charge of the forced removal from the West Coast, he claimed that it was a military necessity that this forced removal happened and to get rid of all of the people with Japanese faces. So, but that was later found to be a lie. And that was, of course, the basis of giving Japanese Americans redress and an apology for this mass incarceration.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Barbara Takei about the mass incarceration of 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, many of them American citizens, during World War II. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Barbara Takei. Stick around. Once again, the quiz guy Doug Smith from James Madison's Montpelier strides purposefully into the studio. How are you, Doug?
I'm doing great, Stuart. How are you doing?
I am doing so well, and I just wonder, do you have you brought a quiz question with you?
Stuart, today you need to call me the Riddler.
What is the Riddler?
Today I have a riddle for you. It's a little more complicated than our normal quiz questions, but I think it's a lot of fun.
Okay, well, we're game. Let's go.
All right. A blindfolded woman holds me. Every musician knows me. I'm found in the forest and in the sea. What am I?
Oh, man. We're going to have to go over this again. Line by line now. What's the first line?
Here we go. A blindfolded woman holds me.
And that's sounding a little suggestive there. Okay, I'm getting kind of excited now. What's next?
Every musician knows me.
That's sounding almost lewd. Okay.
I'm found in the forest and in the sea.
Forest and the sea. Now you've lost me. The forest and the sea.
What am I?
My goodness gracious. I am at a complete loss here. I sincerely hope that our contestant can answer it. Contestant, what do you think? What is your name, contestant?
My name is Jeremy Vanover. I'm from Elkhorn City, Kentucky.
Elkhorn City, Kentucky. Are there actually any elks in Elkhorn City?
There's some. Not plentiful, but they're there.
I see. Are you a hunter?
No, I'm not.
Well, are you a good riddle answerer then?
I like to think of myself as being one, but I guess we'll see.
Okay, well, you've heard Doug's riddle. Do you have an answer?
Well, I'm trying to think. Lady, the blindfolded lady holds, and I'm thinking...
What does she hold?
She holds a balance under the scales.
Scales! That's a fascinating thing. So let me see. Blindfolded lady holding scales, and also, does that fit with the other things? What was it, something about fish or animals in the forest?
Yeah, something that's under the sea.
Right, under the sea, and the forest. You know, that's actually a pretty good answer, it seems to me. Let's see what Doug has to say.
All right, Doug, he's taking his best guess. What's the answer?
Scales.
Indeed. Of course, the scales of justice.
The scales of justice. Lady Justice.
Lady Justice. And of course, on the front of the Supreme Court, the big words say, equal justice under law. It's all about justice. At least the adjudicative process is all about justice. And that's entirely appropriate. And then, of course, the other, the musician scales. Scales on animals in the forest. Who made this up?
There you go. This is our friend Tobias O'Leary of Richmond, Virginia.
Tobias O'Leary of Richmond. Is he at James Madison's Montpelier?
He's not at James Madison's Montpelier. He's at our digital strategy group, INM United, that's been working on our context system.
And he just got so excited about the mission of the center that he said, I want to do some constitutional riddles.
This is a man who loves a good riddle.
Shout out to Tobias. Well done, Tobias. Will he give us some more riddles in the future?
You know, I see having some riddles now and again.
I think so. And when he comes back with more riddles, ladies and gentlemen, we will call the quiz guy...
the Riddler.
Thanks, Doug. Jeremy, congratulations. So are you proud of yourself?
I'm very proud. It was nerve-wracking. I was shaking over here.
You're going to scare future contestants by saying that. Well, you not only get a constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, but you also get a T-shirt. So congratulations, sir.
thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Thanks for playing.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and I'm speaking with Barbara Takei, all about the Japanese incarcerations, Japanese-American incarcerations during World War II, and specifically about the people who were the troublemakers, the resistors, those who objected to these incarcerations. They were all put together at a place called Tule Lake. Before the break, I was talking to Barbara about a strange aspect of all of this that I really wasn't aware of before, and that is that some of the people, the Japanese-Americans who were incarcerated, actually started getting released as the war went on. But the government wouldn't let them go home.
Yeah, I guess I'm just saying that even if one granted the premise, and I'm not saying I do, I'm simply trying to understand if the government action had any logic at all. If you're going to release people, if you've cleared them, then why can't they go home? That's what's sticking in my mind at the moment. I mean, these are people who have been forcibly segregated. They've been put in these camps. They've given the desired answers to the loyalty questionnaire. Mm-hmm. They're being released, and they're told, okay, you can go to Chicago, but you can't go to San Francisco. And I guess I just don't see any logic in that at all.
Oh, well, the logic, really, it lies in the context before World War II, in which there was a great deal of resentment and hostility, first against Chinese who were immigrating, and then against Japanese who were immigrating. And there was concern that the Japanese were a hardworking group of people that were going to take over the state. They were going to take over the control of agriculture. We were defined as a race that was unassimilable.
Hmm.
And
so this was just an attempt at forced assimilation, was that it?
Not forced assimilation, it was to get rid of Japanese Americans from the West Coast, because that was where most of the immigrants were settling.
Hmm.
And beginning to farm and establish their communities. So it was you know, the West was for the white man.
Hmm. I had no idea that was part of this whole process, was this diaspora, as you call it.
Well, the diaspora happened after the camps, mm-hmm. and that was really, it was to make sure that Japanese Americans were going to resettle elsewhere besides the West Coast.
Hmm. Very interesting, but we've strayed a little bit from Tule Lake. We've talked about the people who answered yes, yes to those two questions, but I believe you call the Tule Lake people the no-nos, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, they were known, the people who were segregated to Tule Lake were called, they were referred to as the no-nos. And for most of the past 70 years, the no-nos were known as the disloyals, or the troublemakers. That was the label given them by our own community.
By your own community?
Yeah.
Oh, no, there's a story there. In fact, that was something I was going to ask you about. What was the relationship between the people who answered one way on this loyalty oath and the others?
The 10% of the population that gave the that answered those two loyalty questions concerning military service and loyalty to the emperor, the ones that gave that refused to give unqualified yes answers were the ones who were segregated to Tule Lake, and that was about 10% of the population,
mm-hmm.
or about over 12,000 people.
And how were they treated by the 90% who answered differently, who gave the unqualified yeses?
Well, in the years after the camps were shut down, people recognized that the government defined them as the disloyal. See, in creating segregation and giving those loyalty questions, the government imposed a disloyal paradigm within the Japanese American community, so
mm-hmm.
that there were essentially just, there were two kind of Japanese Americans. There were the ones who were loyal, and those were the ones who gave the so-called correct answers to that loyalty questionnaire. And then there are the ones who were defined as disloyal because they refused to give the answers the government wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And they were the ones segregated at Tule Lake. And for most of the last six decades, the people who were segregated at Tule Lake were treated as our dirty linen, as a secret that, you know, they were the people who rather than being defined as protesters or dissenters against an illegitimate government action, they were defined as disloyal. And because the Japanese American community was so traumatized, they essentially accepted the government's imposition of these really unjust labels. So it's taken a lot of time for the story of Tule Lake and the dissent, all the dissenters at Tule Lake, it's taken a long time for that story to come out and to be integrated as part of the Japanese American narrative. You know, it's just, you know, the idea that you could treat a group of people so unjustly and have no protest, that was the mythology. And so it's taken this long.
Well, tell me some of these stories. Are there still people alive from that era who've shared their stories with you?
Yeah, there. You know, the last since 2004, the Tule Lake pilgrimage has focused on reintegrating the stories of all of those who protested. We've wanted to include those stories as a really important part of our narrative, and so we've sought out and had them as speakers and focused a lot of the stories about Tule Lake on telling the stories of the people who protested and the various forms of their protest and also the consequences of their protest, which led to the repression at Tule Lake and an eventual program in which the government stripped nearly 6,000 people of their citizenship.
Well, tell me more about that. What happened there?
Well, the government had, you know, there had been cries of trying to get rid of Japanese immigrants and also their children who were born in America. This was going on before World War II. So when World War II happened, in 1944, Congress passed legislation and the president signed it that enabled people to renounce their citizenship during times of war. So it was targeted at the Japanese Americans in Tule Lake. And it was a way to for the government to deport them. Because by stripping them of their U.S. citizenship, they could be more easily, well, they would become internees.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Barbara Takei about a place called Tule Lake. This was a special concentration camp here in the United States, in California, where those Japanese Americans who dared to object to their incarceration during World War II got sent. After the break, we'll talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Barbara Takei. Stick around. So Lynn Uzel, Dolly Madison, welcome back. What's happening this week at Montpelier?
Here at Montpelier, we want to get the maximum number of people excited about a constitution on one day. And so, in fact, this year, 2013, we are celebrating Constitution Day on September 21st, which is a Saturday.
Tremendous. So everybody gets to come. And how much is it going to cost? Let's get that right up front.
It is at the bargain basement price of $10 for an entire carload of people.
So get your SUV, cram the kiddies in the back, forget the car seats, just cram them in.
Right, violate the seatbelt laws.
Violate all the laws, put them on the roof rack, and drive them in, and it's only $10.
That's right. And if you are lucky enough to be a resident of Orange County, a carload is only $5.
Even better. Even better. All right. Well, very good. So it's not going to cost very much. What are they going to get for their money?
Oh, let me tell you about that, Stuart.
Oh, please do. Please do.
Every year we have this wonderful group called Project Enlightenment.
Oh, I love those guys.
I love those guys. They are a group of high school students who come here and they play colonial games and they dress up in costume and they play music and they teach the kids how to dance and they teach them how to march military drills.
And these are high school students.
Right, and they're very good at what they do.
They're extremely good. In fact, we did an episode of this show devoted to last year's Constitution Day, and that's probably my favorite part of that entire show is when I was talking to those high school kids. They were just remarkable.
They're so enthusiastic about what they do, and we are so appreciative that they choose to come here every year.
Absolutely. Okay, so Project Enlightenment, singing up a storm and talking to people. What else?
Well, we are also going to have a band. We usually have a military band. I think we're going to have more than one this year.
Right.
And we are going to have balloon rides. We are going to have
like a hot air balloon.
Well, that would be the easiest way to do it.
Yes, yeah. I think so. I mean, we're not talking, you know, little balloons. I mean, balloon rides. I mean, people
right.
actually can get in them and ride it.
Right, hot air balloon.
And it's tethered, if I recall, right?
Yes.
So you're not going to go too high, but you're going to go high enough to
right.
see the mansion and the
right.
grounds and all
and
that.
And okay. so you get a fabulous view of the Blue Ridge Mountains. And it's not as exciting, perhaps, as floating free through the air. But on the other hand, it's also very economically priced and I don't want to say the price over air because I'm afraid that maybe it's changed this year, but it's a very reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also horse-drawn carriage rides.
Very nice.
And there is, of course, the picnic on the lawn. There are some food vendors there, or you can bring your own food, whichever you prefer.
Mm-hmm.
And
In the evening,
I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yes, when you're sitting out there with your picnic dinner.
As the sun descends and darkness falls over the land, then the fireworks begin.
My goodness.
Because we want to make Constitution Day even more exciting than the 4th of July.
Oh, I'm already more excited about it. It falls at a better time of year as far as I'm concerned.
Much more comfortable to be outside.
Especially here in the South,
mm-hmm.
of course. Much more comfortable. In fact, last year, it was idyllic weather. I can't promise that, but it was idyllic.
If you go to Montpelier's website and look on their Facebook page from last year's Constitution Day, you will see the bluest sky that has ever been forming the backdrop of the mansion.
Indeed you will, and you'll see a balloon, and you'll see Dolly and James Madison in that balloon, and portraying Dolly is...
Lynn Uzel.
That's you. That's exactly you. So you actually did get up in the balloon as Dolly Madison.
Yes. As far as I know, that's the first historical time that Dolly Madison was in a hot air balloon.
It's important to point out, those things existed at this time.
That is true.
So theoretically, she could have ridden in such a balloon.
That is correct. And there had been one that had gone up, I think, even in the U.S. by that time.
Wow, that's an interesting thing to think of. Was it hard getting in and out of that basket in your period costume?
I will have to give credit to our wonderful education expert, Christian Coates,
mm-hmm.
who was the complete gentleman and helped Dolly Madison get in and out of the basket. And in her long skirts, there was really no other way than to.
Well, he's a big strapping fellow.
It is a good
helped.
Thing.
Yes, it was. Yes, I'm sure he was able to lift you up and... Not that you're particularly heavy, it's just that it's a very, very cumbersome process. Okay, well, that just sounds fantastic.
And let me also say that this year we also have simultaneously going on that same day, the Taste of Freedom.
The Taste of Freedom, that sounds intriguing.
Oh, it's even more intriguing when I describe it.
Tell me.
We are going to have various vintners and brewers here.
Oh, okay. I'm so there. I am so there. And I hasten to point out that alcohol is protected by the Constitution. This is a constitutional statement of our freedom to consume alcohol.
So, by golly,
that's tremendous. In fact, you can plan all this stuff out and get all of these details by going to montpelier.org. That's MONTPELIER.org.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and I'm speaking with Barbara Takei, all about the Japanese-American incarcerations during World War II, and specifically about the people who were the troublemakers, the resistors, those who objected to these incarcerations. They were all put together at a place called Tule Lake. Okay, so you've got a person who's been an American citizen who's been forcibly removed to a camp, then given the questionnaire, answered the questionnaire with less than an unqualified yes, is now shipped off to Tule Lake.
There were many who were angry and felt that America did not want them and that the only alternative they had was to go to Japan and raise their families. There were many people who used the renunciation process as part of that plan to go to Japan. Many of them had never been to Japan. They were American citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But they felt that the treatment they received by America was, you know, so embittering that they felt, you know, they had very few options other than to go to Japan. There were a lot of other people, too, who the army started rumors that if people renounced their citizenship, that they would not be forced out of Tule Lake before the war was over. You know, they were trying to empty out the camps, and in 1944, the Endo decision was decided, right, that you could not detain somebody, a loyal citizen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so with the Endo decision, people were concerned, thinking they might be forced out of camp. And the war with Japan was still going on. They would not be able to return to their communities, right, on the West Coast.
Right.
So by being forced out, they had no jobs, they had nowhere to live, they had no way to take care of their families because there were no communities for them to go to. So the Army started a rumor that if they renounced their citizenship, that they could stay in Tule Lake.
Well, it sounds like you're making it sound like the government was sort of laying a trap for the Tule Lake people and trying to get them to renounce their citizenship.
Well, that's what it led to. So there were a lot of crazy rumors. People had no idea what was true or what wasn't true. You know, because you've basically got a closed prison system, and a lot of people weren't getting information. Or there were shortwave radios in the camp, and they were listening to Japanese propaganda, propaganda that was coming from Japan, that Japan was winning the war.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, they're getting the news from the camp administrators had their own little newspaper, which, of course, was all propaganda, or people looked at it as propaganda. So it was very difficult for people to know what was true. So you've got all these rumors that people are going to be forced out, you know, with the war still going on. And there was a lot of anxiety, fear, panic, uncertainty. And so a lot of people felt, you know, their citizenship had not protected them at all from incarceration, unjust incarceration. There was no rule of law in Tule Lake. So many of them figured, well, my citizenship hasn't meant much anyway. So if I give it up, what difference does it make? It'll just buy me some time.
Right, now that sounds sort of backward, that people were afraid of being released, but I think you pointed out that, you know, after several years of incarceration and losing everything they had, all their property, losing their communities and not being able to go back to where those communities were,
mm-hmm.
I guess that's what accounted for their reluctance to be released during wartime. They just didn't know how they'd support themselves or what sort of treatment they would get on the outside.
Exactly. Yeah. And, of course, they're all hearing stories about, the handful of people who have left camp and, become victims of hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
People who are beaten up or their places burned down. So people were very hesitant to leave after hearing these kinds of stories of the hostile treatment. And, you know, they knew that the government wasn't going to protect them.
Right.
Or, you know, local law enforcement was not going to protect them. And they didn't have the support of any community. So a lot of people were very hesitant to leave camp by the, at that time.
Well, how many people did renounce their citizenship then?
It was 5,589.
And of those 5,589, what happened to them?
So these are all people who are American citizens who give up their citizenship. Let's see, it was a couple thousand of them ended up going to Japan after the war. And the rest of them were then released to leave camp and resettle wherever they wanted. And they became what is known as Native American aliens, people with no citizenship. So
that's a strange status to have. So you're living within the United States and you're considered an alien, but you actually don't have citizenship anywhere.
You have no citizenship, right. You're not an American citizen, nor are you a Japanese citizen. And it was a tragic situation. It caused so much difficulty for the people who renounced. Anything that required citizenship, they were shut out from. And it created enormous hardship. And it was due only to the efforts of Wayne Collins, who was a lawyer for the ACLU in the Northern California chapter. He even had to resign or take those renunciation cases as a private attorney rather than as a lawyer for the ACLU, because the ACLU did not support the renunciant cases. But Wayne Collins spent over 20 years fighting to get citizenship back for these people who renounced their citizenship.
Did he eventually succeed?
Yeah, nearly all of the people who sought their citizenship back had it returned. But, you know, it was a 20-year ordeal for many of them.
Wow.
And it was a really shocking program. Wayne Collins fought a very lonely battle.
Well, tell me more about this Wayne Collins fellow. Who was he, and why did he get involved in this? It doesn't sound as if he's of Japanese ancestry.
Now, Wayne Collins was a civil rights lawyer in San Francisco, who worked for the Northern California ACLU. And I'm not the legal scholar, so I can't really get into the whole area or explain the whole area, all the cases that he had dealt with. But he had been involved with the Korematsu case, arguing that. He had been involved with defending Eva Toguri, who was known as Tokyo Rose, a World War II propagandist. Which, I mean, it was, you know, totally false charges and part of more U.S. government propaganda, which slandered her. But Wayne Collins fought on her behalf. He was the kind of lawyer who took on a lot of very unpopular cases.
It sounds like it.
And he was an incredible, tenacious lawyer who has really not gotten his due, I think, as far as the work that he's done.
Wow. Well, I'm curious. Now, you mentioned that some people at Tule Lake renounced their citizenship and actually made their way back to Japan, which is itself problematic since I guess they weren't Japanese citizens at that point. What sort of reception did they get? What did they stay? Was it successful from their perspective or not?
Well, one of the things, they went to Japan and, of course, found that Japan was devastated. People were starving. Because they were not Japanese, most of them were not, did not hold dual citizenship. And they, because of that, did not get a rice allotment that, you know, a citizen would get.
Mm-hmm.
So they became a burden. If they had extended family in Japan, they were burdens on their families.
Not to mention the fact that they had been, you know, despite all of their difficulties, they had been up until quite recently, from the Japanese perspective, enemy citizens. So I wonder if that complicated their quote-unquote homecoming to Japan.
Well, right. The Japanese looked at them as Americans.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, these people didn't have a place to go and call home.
Right. And so while they in Japan, one of the things that they found is that their language skills were extremely valuable, the fact that they spoke both English and Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
So they were very valuable to the U.S. occupation forces stationed in Japan. So, ironically, these people who are defined as disloyal Americans then become valuable to the Japanese occupying forces. Because of their ability to translate documents and to communicate with the Japanese. But
that is a strange odyssey to be plucked up from your house one day in Los Angeles and a couple of years later, after going through this prison camp system, ending up in Japan, assisting the Army of the United States occupying Japan.
Right.
Strange odyssey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very strange.
Did any of them, by and large, did people who went to Japan, did they come back? Did they stay in Japan? Where are they now?
Most of them ended up, there were many who did remain in Japan, really because they felt America was, you know, was not the place they believed it was, and their experiences in the U.S. were very embittering.
Is there still an expatriate community, if I might term it that way?
Most of them, the age group that they were, they were adults or young adults, and so most of them are gone.
Mm-hmm.
But the majority of those who repatriated or expatriated to Japan after the war ended up coming back to the U.S. because the conditions after the war were very difficult. And most of them were impoverished by the experience. So most of them ended up coming back to the U.S. and living, I think, a life in which they felt they needed to conceal their history.
Hmm.
So people who renounced their citizenship haven't, you know, they haven't talked about it much. And the Japanese-American community, which has been so anxious about the perceptions of loyalty or disloyalty, was really not interested in bringing the story of those renunciants into the general narrative. So, our narrative has tended to stress the military service.
Yeah, some of the people in the camps actually served in the U.S. Army.
Right.
That's always been the story, is that these people were all very loyal, and despite their mistreatment, that they showed their colors as true Americans.
Right.
That's all very inspiring, but it does leave the Tule Lake people sort of on the sidelines, doesn't it, or in the closet.
Yeah, and of course, stories of military service and sacrifice are always, they tend to be very beautiful stories, and they're very useful propaganda tools. But when you look at the stories of Tule Lake, The stories have been, you know, all of these stories have been so manipulated by, in service of the government, in service of the military, in service of, even with getting redress, you know, making the argument of why Japanese Americans should get redress, the emphasis has been on the loyalty, stories of loyalty. And the stories of civil rights protests have not been as useful in making the arguments of the injustice of the incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
And so those stories have been pushed aside.
Well, I have to ask now, were some of your relatives incarcerated at Tule Lake?
My mother was incarcerated at Tule Lake, and all of her family. And my husband's family were not incarcerated. Well, his father was interned. He was picked up early and interned in a Department of Justice camp after having a little kangaroo court hearing about his disloyalty.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So,
what was your mother's experience at Tule Lake?
Well, my mother's experience at Tule Lake, she was there before segregation, and she ended up leaving Tule Lake to get married to my father, who had been drafted. My father was drafted in February of 1941, nearly a year before Pearl Harbor. And he had gone through his basic training. And
Wait a second. He was in the United States Army?
Right.
Having been drafted.
He was drafted, right.
And then he was pulled out of the United States Army and given this hearing you mentioned and then sent to an internment camp.
No, with my father, he was drafted before Pearl Harbor, went through basic training, and then when Pearl Harbor happened, his weapons were taken from him, he was put under guard, and served time in prisoner of war camps. There was one in Griffith Park, and there was also one at Fort Bliss, Texas.
And I have to ask, did he do anything in the Army that could justify such treatment?
Well, he had a Japanese face.
I'm talking about anything that legitimately could. He was an honorable soldier up to that point.
Right.
Tell me if I'm speaking differently, but it sounds to me that the only thing that happened was that the Japanese attacked us.
Right, exactly. And then he suddenly became, he was recategorized as an enemy alien, 4C.
Now, see, you're telling me something I did not know. I did not know that among the American citizens who were incarcerated at these various camps, some of them were actually serving honorably in the U.S. military
right.
at that time. That's
right.
A striking story.
Right. And what is really shocking is those soldiers, there were many who protested their treatment. You know, they said that we've gone through basic training. We are loyal Americans. We're serving in your military. And now, you know, you take away our weapons and you treat us as enemy aliens. And so there were stories of military protesters, Japanese Americans who were mistreated because of their Japanese faces and their heritage. And those stories also are only slowly starting to come out.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Barbara Takei for talking to us about Tule Lake and about the Japanese incarcerations of World War II generally. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.